Assuming this web page is correct, so.
Okay. Anybody else have any other announcements? Okay, Carl.
Okay, our invited speaker is Dr. Thomas Brown, who is based off of Science Institute in Baltimore. Tom is currently the head of the JWST Mission Office at the Institute. And as the Institute leadership page and actually our Stardust bio write-up state, he is responsible for overseeing JWST's science and flight operations as head of the mission office, responsible for collaborating with mission stakeholders, engaging the scientific community and the public, and ultimately maximizing the mission's scientific return. So, having worked with and for Tom for several years at the Institute on both Hubble and Webb, HST and JWST, I'd like to just elaborate a little bit on his job description and cover some aspects that tend to get in these types of write-ups tend to get glossed over. The job of the JWST mission lead at the Institute, of course, requires a very competent astrophysicist, which Tom is, but also requires a competent project manager. That's because a mission like JWST consists of obviously a complex operation of spacecraft that's operating, serving as a state-of-the-art telescope, which in turn forms the core of a world-class observatory. So we have the primary space segment being the telescope itself, but you also have the vast ground system constituting the observatory. And as such, the observatory needs to be capable of accepting proposals, allocating telescope time, scheduling the observations, capturing and archiving the science and engineering data, making them available to the original proposers, as well as eventually to the whole world. So the JWST mission lead has to be technically and scientifically adept in all these areas: spacecraft flight, telescope operation, and observatory ground system operation, while at the same time routinely interfacing with NASA management, both at Goddard and at NASA headquarters downtown, and overseeing and coordinating a vast array of teams and subcontractors at the Institute, at NASA, overseeing the work, coordinating the work of the Canadian Space Agency and the European Space Agency, and of course, managing the JWST budget and schedule. That obviously, all that takes a very special skill set. And I know that Tom is particularly suited to this position of JWST mission lead because for many years he did the same job, more or less the same job, highly successfully as the HST, Hubble Space Telescope mission lead at the Institute. And we all know how successful HST has been. On top of all that, he's an Institute staff astronomer, producing cutting-edge research, using several astronomical facilities, and has been published many times in prominent astronomy and astrophysical journals, the Astronomy Journal and the Astrophysical Journal, among others. And we'll see the fruits of some of that research in just a few minutes, in a couple of minutes. But before we do, I'd just like to ask Tom about the last line in the bio that I believe appears in the Stardust bio. That alludes to your research appearing not only in peer-reviewed journals, but also on one album cover. Remind me, please, whose album that is and what's the image?
Sure, and thanks for all that, Carl. That was a longer introduction as I'm expecting. Thanks. Yeah, that brief bio I gave you guys had it's David Bowie's album cover, his last album cover, Black Star, has a star field in it, and that's an image I took with the advanced camera for surveys right after it was installed in Hubble, about 20 years ago. It's still the deepest visible band image ever taken of the sky. It goes down below 31st magnitude in V
Oh.
band. And it's about 1/4 million stars across the field. And they used it. I didn't know about it until a friend of mine bought the album and said, "Isn't that that picture you took with Hubble?" And I went, "Oh, because it's not like we get royalties or anything, right?" And so, but in if you open up the album, especially it's easier to see on the LP. You could see the star fields in there. Yeah.
You credited in it?
Nah, it just says NASA. If you look, if you hold it up to the light, all the words on it are kind of like artistically blended into the star fields. If you kind of hold it up to the light, it says credit NASA. That's fine, whatever. But like I said, a few folks who knew about that I took it was like, "Isn't that your picture?" And I said, "Yeah." And so, but I didn't know about it in advance. Literally, it was on the shelves, and then some people picked it up and told me about it. Yeah. So.
Well, okay, so those are some pretty good credentials, I would say. Tonight, Tom's talk is entitled "On the Trail of Missing Galaxies: The Oldest Stars in the Neighborhood." Well, take it away, Tom.
All right, thank you, Carl. And let's see if this works. I tried this out right before when it was just Carl and me on here. All right. Can folks see that all right?
Yeah, looks good.
All right. So yeah, I'll be talking to you tonight about the missing galaxies problem in astronomy, which you might have heard about before. It's a long-standing problem. And this is also related to the oldest stars we know about in the nearby universe. This is work I've been doing as part of my research at Space Telescope. And it's been in collaboration with the folks here. And I'll just apologize up front. I'm originally from New York, even though I live in Maryland now, and I have a tendency to get going and talk very rapidly. I'm going to try very hard to not do that during the next half hour here or so, 40 minutes. But you know, if this talk winds up being half the speed, I promise, Carl, it's because I went too fast again. But this is my team of collaborators from around the world who've worked with me on this research. I'd just like to acknowledge them here and the series of papers we published on what I'm going to show you here. So this is a simulation from Ben Moore in University of Zurich, just showing over cosmic time how the evolution of large scale structure proceeds in the universe, starting from around the time of the Big Bang up until the present. And what this is showing you is this filamentary structure that the dark matter of the universe consists of. And I'll just rewind this once here and show it again. So basically what happens as you move into the modern era from the time of the Big Bang, you have this coalescing and filamentary structure, and all these brighter nodules you see in here are places of overdensity in the universe where these are the seeds of galaxy formation. And this is the backdrop of what a lot I'll be talking about tonight. If we zoom in to the dark matter distribution as it probably exists in the vicinity of the Milky Way, this is what it should look like. So this is the Milky Way at the center of this gravitational potential well. And there are a few hundred of these satellite dark matter clumps floating around the Milky Way. And the scale here is about 1 million light years, is what I'm showing you here on the side here. This is from my collaborator Jason Tumlinson, who does this theoretical work on the dark matter distribution of the universe. And this is basically a zoom in on that animation I showed you earlier, just right around the Milky Way. So the dark matter distribution of the universe says that we should have a few hundred dark matter clumps, the seeds of galaxy formation, right around the Milky Way. But that's the crux of the missing satellite problem. So for decades now, astronomers have been vexed by the fact that theory predicts far more dark matter clumps orbiting the Milky Way and the nearby Andromeda Galaxy than the number of dwarf satellites observed. So in the past 2 decades, new wide field surveys of the entire sky have added many smaller galaxies to the census of nearby galaxies. They haven't made up all of the ground here. We've discovered a lot more. We still have ways to go. But given how the progress lately, we think we're going to solve the missing satellite problem by finding these. But why were these galaxies so hard to find? And just to give you some numbers here, before 1990, we only knew about 9 satellite galaxies orbiting the Milky Way, our own galaxy. And then 2 more were discovered in the 1990s, and more than 60 have been discovered since the turn of the century. So we've really discovered many more. Now we're not up to the several hundred that should be in this simulation here, but we're making a lot of progress in that direction. So the reason why we think that it's been so hard to find these satellite galaxies is because of the way the universe evolves. So this is probably due to the fact the cosmic randomization of the universe. So what I'm showing you is a really rough cartoon of time flow from the Big Bang on the left to the modern era on the right. And so you have the Big Bang over here about 13.8 billion years ago. You have the Dark Ages immediately after that for a few hundred million years. The universe cools enough to become neutral, chemically neutral. Then the first stars and galaxies form about 200 million years after the Big Bang. And matter of fact, Webb is now seeing galaxies as they were only 300 million years after the Big Bang. Actually, a little earlier than that, about 280 is the current record. So Webb is pushing back right now further and further to the Big Bang, directly looking back in time. The reionization of the universe occurred over this period that I'm highlighting here. This is not to linear scale, by the way. It's more of a cartoon, just so you can see what things are happening. So, the reionization of the universe occurred for hundreds of millions of years, until we got to about 1 billion years after the Big Bang. And then galaxies continue to evolve. New stars were born from enriched gas. The sun was born about 4.5 billion years ago, and here we are today. So here we go back to this simulation of what the universe looks like here. So here are the dark matter clumps around the Milky Way. And the theory goes, why were these galaxies so hard to find, these little baby satellite galaxies? Well, some of them were bright enough to continue forming stars after that epoch of reionization. So I'm highlighting those here in green. And so these would correspond to the classical dwarf galaxies that people have known about forever in the night sky. In red here, I'm highlighting ones that were much harder to find. And the theory here is that these galaxies, when they started forming stars right after the Big Bang, were snuffed out by with lights coming on in the universe, essentially. So when the first stars and galaxies formed, they caused the star formation to truncate in the smallest galaxies and basically blew the gas out of them, and they stopped forming stars. And then most of the dark matter clumps don't form stars at all in this theory. So that's the explanation for why it was so hard to find some of these galaxies. And indeed, we still haven't found all the missing satellites, but we're making headway. So just to, if this is true, if this is true, then there should be ancient dwarf galaxies besides the bright dwarf galaxies that we've known about for decades. So here's a classical dwarf galaxy that we've known about for many decades. You might have seen it outside yourself. This is the Fornax galaxy. It's orbiting the Milky Way. It's a classical dwarf galaxy with millions of stars that has a wide range of age and a wide range of chemistry. And so this is from the European Southern Observatory. You can see this overdensity of stars in here in the middle of the picture. So that's the Fornax galaxy. Now, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey started about 20 years ago, and using a 2.5 optical telescope, 2.5 meter optical telescope at Apache Point, New Mexico. And this one paper here summed up all the images from this wide-scale survey. So if this picture I'm showing you here is tens of degrees across on a side. And you can see there's structure in this picture. So Sloan was mapping the sky, doing this wide field survey, and they picked up structure. And what we right away got was many more of these dwarf galaxies were found. And so again, this is tens of degrees across on the side here. And each of these little pink circles I'm showing here are new dwarf galaxies that were starting to fill in the census of dwarf galaxies. And this paper was published back in 2007. Besides these pink circles here that are all labeled, also uncovered tidal debris from galaxies that have been torn apart in the gravitational well of the Milky Way. So I'm showing here the Sagittarius Stream, the Orphan Stream, the Mount Osiris Ring. So there's also tidal debris streams from dwarf galaxies plummeting into the gravitational well and getting ripped apart over cosmic history. So since then, there have been other wide field surveys. Matter of fact, this is all the rage in the coming decade as well. Mapping the sky, there's the Dark Energy Survey, which is a 4 meter optical telescope at CTIO in Chile. There's the Pan-STARRS survey with the 1.8 meter optical telescope in Hawaii. And then Subaru, the 8.2 meter Subaru telescope has been used in this one survey here called the Subaru Strategic Survey. It's also in Hawaii. And all these surveys have been finding more and more of these little dwarf galaxies. So I've told you, for decades, astronomers only knew about 9 or 10 dwarf galaxies around the Milky Way. Now we know over 70 of them, most of them discovered in the past 20 years. As I mentioned, the next decade, really starting this year, is really going to see a lot of growth in this area. So the Rubin Observatory in Chile is an 8.4 meter optical telescope that's going to scan the southern sky every night. And it's going to have two big benefits from that. One is it's going to return to the same patch as the sky over and over again. So there's going to be an explosive growth in transient phenomena discovered with this observatory. But then as you add up all those images from years and years of observing, you're going to have a very deep map of the whole southern sky. And then also the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. It's a Hubble-sized telescope, but working on longer light wavelengths. So it's 2.4-meter aperture, funded by NASA. We're one of the operation centers, that space telescope. That's launching in either late 2026 or early 2027. It's also going to have a wide field camera that maps the whole sky. This will do great work in this area as well. And just to give you a comparison of Hubble, Webb, and Roman. So this is the nearby Andromeda Galaxy, and what's tiled here. So that image I mentioned on the David Bowie album was a deep image I took of Andromeda, which is one field on Hubble. Sometime collaborator of mine, Julianne Del Canton, she did this wide field survey using Hubble. So all the little tiles you see here, there's a mosaic in the background. And that's a Hubble image of 800 orbits of Hubble time, mapping out a section of the Andromeda Galaxy. And you can see that what's indicated there is the Webb field of view and the Hubble field of view. Hubble and Webb are used for targeted observations. You know, we look at some interesting object, or if you want to map a big piece of the sky like this map of Andromeda here, you kind of move the telescope around and tile the whole sky. Roman, its wide field camera has the field of view you see here. So many times that of Hubble, over 100 times that of Hubble or Webb. And so Roman is really much more of a survey telescope instead of a targeted observation telescope. And then the relative wavelengths are shown here at the bottom. So Hubble works from the ultraviolet into the optical into the near infrared. Roman works from kind of the longest wavelengths in the visible out to the near infrared. And then Webb works from the near infrared out into the mid infrared. So they all complement each other, both in field of view and wavelength coverage. And they have very different mirrors, by the way. I'm showing there on the left. So Hubble and Roman are both 2.4-meter telescopes, and Webb's in 6.5-meter. So let me tell you a little bit more back to these ultra-faint dwarf galaxies that were discovered in the last 20 years. So again, we're starting to uncover new galaxies in the galaxy census. And I'll make an analogy here just so you could put things in perspective. So on the top left here, I'm showing you a giant spiral galaxy, very much like our own Milky Way or the Andromeda Galaxy. And it has of order 100 billion stars in it. And again, I'm from New York, so I'm not on the bottom left here, I'm going to make the analogy to a large city of 10 million people. Now, I'm going to give you a sense of scale here. The classical dwarf galaxies that have been known to orbit the Milky Way for many, many decades, like 4x, have on the order of around 10 million stars. So they're much smaller than the 100 billion stars in the Milky Way itself. And just to make the analogy, that's like scaling this large city of 10 million people down to a theater in that city of these folks watching the Lion King of about 1,000 people sitting in the audience. So now, if I go one more step down, these are the ultra-faint dwarf galaxies I'm talking about. So these ultra-faint dwarf galaxies have around 10,000 stars in them. So they're smaller in terms of star counts than many star clusters that you might have gone outside and observed yourself with your telescope. And that's like taking the theater down on the left on the bottom here to carry the analogy forward, just taking it to one person, right? The host of a talk show in New York City. So this is these, you know, these ultra-faint dwarf galaxies are much, much smaller than the Milky Way itself, right? It's like one person in 10 million, basically, is the analogy I'm making for you here. Now, I said they're dimmer than some star clusters, so why do we even call them galaxies, right? Like a globular star cluster, which you know is a B swarm of stars that are among the most ancient objects in the universe, they routinely have around 100,000 stars in them. So that's an image there on the left of actually of a globular star cluster in the Andromeda Galaxy. On the right here, that's taken with Hubble on the left, on the right is one of these ultra-faint dwarf galaxies. They only have 10,000 stars. So you might say, well, why are we calling the thing on the left a star cluster, and the thing on the right, a galaxy? The star cluster has more stars. There's a couple big differences. Globular clusters, to first approximation, have no dark matter really, as far as we can tell. So they have a mass to light ratio in units of solar units, of, you know, solar mass and solar luminosity, of about 2, which is consistent with just a group of old stars and no dark matter. Whereas galaxies have significant dark matter. So the classical dwarf galaxy we've known about for many years, like I said, the ones that we knew about before the turn of the century, they have mass to light ratios of around 10 because they have a lot of dark matter. These new ultra-faint dwarf galaxies, again, if you remember the theory in the beginning when I was saying there are these clumps of dark matter that formed very few stars and then were snuffed out, these ultra-faint dwarf galaxies, as far as we can tell, have mass to light ratios of over 100. So they're dominated by dark matter, which again goes with the theory that they were probably had their star formation turned off, even though the seed of dark matter is still there. Another distinction is that globular clusters, like the object on the left here, are usually what we call simple stellar populations. So to first order, the stars are all at one age and one chemical composition, roughly speaking. Galaxies are much more complex. So they have a wide range of chemistry from star to star, and they have a wide range of ages. And so this is true also of most of the galaxies we've looked at before. So this is how we distinguish between galaxies and star clusters generally. So what I'm plotting here now is a diagram just to try to drive this point home on luminosity on a logarithmic scale in solar units on the y-axis versus diameter in light years, again in logarithmic units. So star clusters are these white points here on the left-hand side. These globular star clusters have a diameter in light years of one to a few light years, and they have luminosities of about 1,000 to maybe 100,000 or maybe even 1,000,000 for the brightest ones, solar luminosities. So they all cluster around here. Globular star clusters are these white points. The classical dwarf galaxies, like Fornax I mentioned before, are these teal objects in the upper right. They tend to be much more extended in diameter, so hundreds of light years across, and they tend to be much more luminous. These new ultra-faint dwarf galaxies that I'm showing in pink at the bottom look like an extension of those to fainter luminosities. They're still pretty wide on the sky. They still have a diameter of 100 light years or so, but they just have far fewer stars. And I'll be talking to you tonight about six of them that I pointed at with Hubble to try to get very accurate ages and chemistry for them. So how do we know if a group of stars is old? Well, there's a couple things we can do. We can get spectroscopy of the stars, and that shows you the abundances of metals in their atmospheres. And if the stars were born from relatively pristine gas, it means they were probably born in the early universe. And then we can also do photometry. If only low-mass stars are present, because all the high-mass stars, the massive stars, die more quickly and they died off in the early universe, that would also indicate that these objects are old if all we have left are low-mass stars. So just to talk about spectroscopy for a moment. So we've obtained spectra of the stars in these ultra-faint dwarf galaxies, spectra like what I'm showing here on the left. And this tells us a couple of things. It gives us stellar motions. We can use the Doppler effect to imply the presence of significant dark matter by watching the absorption lines move back and forth as we observe the star. And then also the absorption lines in these objects are very weak. So the stars in the ultra-faint dwarf galaxies typically have metal abundances that are 100 to 10,000 times less abundant than what we see in our own sun. So the sun was born from enriched gas 4.5 billion years ago, but the stars in these ultra-faint dwarf galaxies have very little chemistry, and that means they were born in the early universe before the universe got polluted. And so many of the most metal-poor stars we've ever discovered in astronomy have, in fact, been found in these ultra-faint dwarf galaxies. So, folks, that's a whole other area of research where people are just trying to find very early metal-poor stars, and they tend to look in these ultra-faint dwarf galaxies because it's a rich ground for finding them. So this is an image of a megasun, a globular cluster taken with Hubble. And I'm going to zoom in here. This is a real image, but we're going to shift it around, sorting it by color and luminosity. So first, we're going to sort this image by color, with hot blue stars to the left and cool red stars to the right. And this is how we actually measure the age for a group of stars. So you can see it's not random right away here if I sort in color. But now we're going to soon sort in luminosity with bright stars at the top and faint stars at the bottom. And when you do this for a group of stars like a globular cluster, these are the stars in the Omega-Sun globular cluster, you can see it's totally not random. The pattern you trace out here is the life cycle of a star. So main sequence stars burning hydrogen are down here on the lower part. When they exhaust their hydrogen, evolve into red giant stars, which are some of the brighter stars you can see in the night sky. And then they ignite helium in their cores. They become helium-burning stars, horizontal branch stars, and then they eventually die as white dwarfs. So this is what we call a color magnitude diagram. And if we measure with a telescope like Hubble the distribution of colors and luminosities in a group of stars, we can measure its age based upon making that kind of diagram, essentially. So that's an animation from two of my collaborators at Space Telescope, Jay Anderson and Roland Vandermaal, who work at the Institute. And I just think it's an effective way of showing this method of getting the ages for a group of stars.
That's really beautiful.
Thanks, Carl. So this is now using theory to show you what this looks like on Hubble. So for those of you who observe in visible band passes, I know this is an astronomy club. So these are band passes on Hubble that correspond roughly to V and I. So this is I brightness on the y-axis here, and then V minus I color on the bottom here, with redder colors on the right, bluer colors on the left, brighter magnitudes at the top. So if you take the measurements of photometry for a group of stars, you get an accurate clock, and it's basically this kink in the middle here where stars are peeling away from the hydrogen burning phase and becoming brighter red giants. So, yeah, the more massive hydrogen burning stars are right up near the kink, and then the less massive hydrogen burning stars that are not close to dying yet are lower in the diagram. And where that actual kink occurs tells you the clock. So, stars that are still burning hydrogen in the core are down here, and then stars that have exhausted their core hydrogen are up at the top, and they're the red giant stars. And so that's the clock, basically. And this is the gold standard in astronomy. For 50 years in astronomy, there have been a lot of methods to measure ages in groups of stars. And that's a whole, you can give a whole talk on that subject. The method I use with Hubble to look at star clusters and galaxies is this method, which has been proven for, like I said, more than 50 years, going back to some very early papers in the 60s and even the 50s, really. So this is what a group of stars looks like at 13 billion years old. And then if we were looking at a group of 6 billion years old, so it's 13, 6, you can see it's dramatically different. And if you get very accurate photometry with Hubble, you can actually get exquisitely sensitive ages for a group of stars in the nearby universe. So again, here's another classical dwarf spheroidal galaxy. This is one we've known about for many decades before the recent burst in the census of finding new satellites. So this is the Carina classical dwarf galaxy. And if you make one of these diagrams for the photometry in this image, measure the colors and brightnesses in all these stars, you get this here, which is interesting because it tells a story even before you try to model it in any way. So this is brightness in the V band on the Y axis and B minus V color on the X axis. And the diagram looks pretty complex. I'm going to draw some cartoon curves through here. There's basically three bursts of star formation in here. And that's why there's three, if I show this here, that's why you see these three traces in the stellar locus. So right away, if you make one of these diagrams looking at this galaxy, you can see it had three bursts of star formation at three different ages. So now I'll go back here to this diagram. This is, again, luminosity versus diameter for globular star clusters, dwarf galaxies, and the ultra-faint dwarf galaxies. And we picked six of them to look at with Hubble that I've highlighted here in yellow, having a little bit of a range in diameter and a little bit of a range in luminosity. We couldn't target the very faintest ones because they had too few stars to actually apply this method. You would go point Hubble at it and you'd get a few stars and you wouldn't really be able to say anything about its age. So this is Combera. We spent 24 orbits on Hubble. As I mentioned, Hubble's more of a targeting observatory. It doesn't have a wide field of view. So we took two of the instruments on Hubble, the Wide Field Camera 3, the WFC3, and the Advanced Camera for Surveys, the ACS, and we tiled out a region of this galaxy. It's relatively nearby, so it takes a pretty wide area on the sky to get enough stars. And so we tiled an area with Hubble for this galaxy. This was about 24 orbits on Hubble. And now for Leo 4, this galaxy is further away. It's about 150 kiloparsecs away, still in orbit around the Milky Way. And so for this, because it's further away, we can get more of the galaxy within a single shot. So we looked with Wide Field Camera 3 and ACS here. And again, measure the brightnesses and colors of the stars for 16 orbits, just in one pencil beam with each camera shooting through each galaxy, I mean, each field pointing. So here's the Leo 4 Hubble image. So this is about 16 orbits with Hubble, and it gets down to almost 29th magnitude in the V band. And there's a bunch of stars in here. And then, like every Hubble image since the Advanced Camera for Surveys was installed in 2002, pretty much every Hubble image for the last 20, 25 years since that camera was installed has the rest of the universe in the background in every shot, which is pretty cool. So I, as a nearby stars guy, I like all the little point-like things in this image, but most people like the pretty faint fuzzies in these galaxies, and that's just messed up real estate for me that I can't use for my measurements. But they do make for very pretty pictures. So I'll just zoom in on this one patch right here, so you can see these beautiful background galaxies that are way, way, way in the background in the distant universe. And what I'm interested in here are these stars I've circled right here. So these are 25th magnitude stars. These are the brightest stars in this galaxy that are still burning hydrogen in their cores, but they're about to evolve off and become red giant branch stars. So these are the kind of stars that give you the clock. And so now here's the Hubble image again, and I'm going to do something similar to what you saw in that earlier animation. I'm going to sort these by color and luminosity again, but then I'm also going to roll them back in time just so you can get a sense of the clock. So here's the image. There's where all the stars in that galaxy are, and this is where they fall in a color magnitude diagram at an age of 13 billion years old. If I use theory to roll these back, this is what this diagram would look like when the galaxy was only a billion years old. This is where the distribution of brightnesses and colors would be. And then we roll it back to the present day using those same theoretical models. This is the distribution of color and luminosity we have today. And this is the actual measurements we made of those stars, which I just laid out right there. So those are the stars. They're pretty sparse in this image, but we measured photometry for all of those. And we did this for six galaxies. So here are the six color magnitude diagrams we measured for those six galaxies. And they're all a little different because they're all at different distances. Some of them are only about 50 kiloparsecs away, and some of them are more like 150 kiloparsecs away. And they're all in orbit around the Milky Way. They're the same six galaxies I highlighted in yellow earlier in that diagram. And because they're all different distances, the y-axis here, that clock is actually shifting around in apparent magnitude just because they're all different distances. But we can use comparisons to see how old they are, and that's what I'll show you here next. So this is a half second exposure with Hubble of a very famous globular cluster called M92, also known as NGC 6341. And theorists love this cluster because it's among the oldest n objects known to humankind. It seems to be coeval at about 13 billion years old. It's very metal poor. The chemistry in this star cluster is less than 1% of the solar chemistry. It's a globular cluster, and again, because it's pretty bright on the sky, it's only about I think 3 kiloparsecs away, or maybe a little beyond that. But it's relatively nearby for Hubble. This is a half second exposure, so we didn't saturate the camera. And what we do here is we, again, here's brightness on the y-axis, color on the x-axis. We can measure this shape now you should be getting familiar with as I keep showing it to you. This is the locus of stars. I can draw a green curve through that and use this as a reference. And then up in the upper left there, I'm showing in green points, that's the horizontal branch. That's a pretty good standard candle that you can use to make sure as a sanity check that your distance is correct. I'm going to compare M92 to those galaxies I showed you before. So here are the galaxies, each of their color magnitude diagrams. And what I'm going to do is take this M92 data and superimpose it on each of those just using distance to put it in each diagram because that cluster is nearby. If I shift it in distance, it falls right on top of the stellar locus in each and every case. And that's because each of these galaxies, unlike all the galaxies we had studied before this, which had a range of ages, each of these galaxies seems to first order to be coeval at about 13 billion years old, which is what my friend Jason Tumlinson predicted in his theoretical paper in 2010, that these very, very faint galaxies, if you remember the cartoon I showed you at the beginning, the faintest galaxies were probably snuffed out right after the Big Bang and stopped forming stars. And that's what we're seeing here. These data with Hubble allow us to measure how old these galaxies are, and they all appear to be roughly about 13 billion years old. Most of the stars are 13 billion years old, with very few stars younger than that. And this is in contrast to any other galaxies we've looked at. Normally, if we point Hubble or a ground telescope or Webb at a galaxy in the nearby universe and measure the brightnesses and colors of the stars, they show a wide range, as I was showing you some examples before, because star formation continued for billions of years after the Big Bang. But that's not the case here. These are the chemistries of these stars, just for completeness here. This is with the Keck telescope. So some of the people on the team have access to Keck time in Hawaii. So these are little six histograms here for the same six galaxies. This is the number of stars on the y-axis and the chemistry on the x-axis. And the chemistries are all pretty low. This is a logarithmic scale. Even on the right, the most metal-rich stars are only 10% of solar. And M92 would fall right here. It's very metal poor. As I mentioned earlier in this talk, some of the most metal poor stars we know about are in these galaxies. So anything to the left of the green line in each of those six panels there are among the most metal poor stars known in the universe. So again, that reinforces that these galaxies were born right after the Big Bang, before the universe was polluted. Now, another way to show that these galaxies are weird is that, galaxies should all be kind of, have their own characteristics, but these all look very similar because they were all snuffed out right after the Big Bang. And so what I'm going to do here is show you the color magnitude diagram for Hercules and then put on top of it, superimpose the color magnitude diagram for the other five galaxies, just shifting them by relative distances so that they line up. And if I do that, so here's Hercules in yellow. Here's Leo 4 in green. You can't even really tell I put it there because it looks almost the same. Here's CVN2 in purple, falls right on top. Ursa Major 1, and I guess that's teal. I'm colorblind, but I think it's teal. That falls right on top. Here's Bootes 1, and here's Combert. All six galaxies their data points with some noise scatter here because they're not perfect measurements fall right on top of each other, all chase the same stellar locus. That's right what you'd expect, what I'm showing here in gray for an old population of stars. And for folks who study the ages of galaxies, this was shocking when I showed this to my colleagues, because again, normally when you take this kind of measurement and you measure the brightnesses there on the y-axis and the colors on the x-axis, which is something you can do in any nearby stellar image with Hubble or with Webb or another telescope, you see a much wider distribution of colors and brightnesses because you see a much larger range in ages and chemistry. But these things all look coeval. They're all about 13 billion years old, and they're all very metal poor because they were all born right after the Big Bang and it stopped forming stars. So these are among the no oldest known objects in the universe. So let's go back to this cartoon in the beginning again. It's not just that these galaxies, these newly discovered galaxies, are old. They all look the same. And so they seem to be synchronized in some way. And that means you want to think about a synchronizing phenomenon. What would synchronize different galaxies that are orbiting the Milky Way at all different distances? What global force could be synchronizing the galaxies? And it's something like reionization. So it goes back to that theory that Jason Tumlinson had in his 2010 paper. The reionization of the universe, it came on for the whole universe and snuffed out star formation in these little galaxies right after they started forming stars. And just to show you how well we can model this, this is the Hercules color magnitude diagram again, zoomed in on the clock region. In orange or blue, I'm showing the data, and in orange or blue, I'm showing a simulation from our stellar models of what the data should look like. And I don't know if you can tell which is which because I haven't labeled them. But one of those is a simulation drawn upon the stellar evolution models we have. And one of them is the actual data from Hubble. And I can do that for all of these. And it's pretty hard to tell the difference. And I intentionally didn't label data or model in each case because I wanted folks to actually look at it without bias. You can tell that the models reproduce the distribution really well. And I'll just label them here. So in each case, we have carefully modeled the distribution of stars in each galaxy. And each of these six pairs here, three on the top, three on the bottom, the galaxy name is the data, and then model is right alongside it on the right, showing the model. And so we can use pretty accurate models to get accurate ages for these galaxies. And again, I mean, the fits are pretty close to the real data. It's pretty hard to distinguish between them. And then just for reference, the green curve in each case is again M92, which is just an old globular cluster. And that's just to show you the model there a different way, just to kind of drive the point home. And so the mean age, the average age of the stars in each of these models, now I'm showing each panel. So in each case, it's about 13 billion years and change. Now, the one in the upper right is 13.9 billion years. And this shows you a shortcoming of the theory. The universe is only 13.8 billion years old. So I'm not telling you tonight that this galaxy is older than the universe. What I'm telling you is that there's an uncertainty of about a half billion years in the ages we can measure. But that's pretty good when you're talking about objects almost as old as the universe. So the mean age in each of these cases has an error on it of about half a billion years. So the oldest one on the upper right there, within the error bars, it's about as old as the Big Bang itself. This shows the ages of stars in a different way here. So on the y-axis, I'm plotting the fraction of stars formed versus time on the x-axis. So this is how long ago the stars formed. And so this pink curve is basically the uncertainty in the model. And so way back 14 billion years ago on the lower left, the fraction of stars born was pretty much zero. And then as we roll the clock forward, moving to the right, you get to about 100% of the stars formed by around 11 billion years or so, or maybe 10 to 9 billion years ago if we take the most extreme models. And that's true in all of these. In all six galaxies, stars started forming right after the Big Bang, about 14 billion years ago. And by around 10 billion years ago, star formation was done. And they've just been sitting there quiet ever since, waiting to be discovered. And because their star formation was turned off so early, they were very hard to find because they're so faint on the sky. It was only these very recent surveys that were able to discover them. So I like to switch gears here a little bit for the last few minutes. And say that the local universe is actually a pretty boring part of the universe to do this kind of work. So if you're interested in doing the ages of galaxies, which is what I do, there's two ways you could do this work if you're an astronomer. You can look at nearby galaxies and try to accurately measure the motions of the stars, the chemistry, colors, and brightnesses of the stars. And what we do, stellar archaeology is what folks sometimes call that. Or you could use a telescope like a time machine and look directly back in time, which we do that with the web a lot, with James Webb. You look in the distant universe because of the finite light travel time, you're actually looking directly back in time. And those two methods are complementary. The kind of work I do is I do this looking at the nearby universe to try to age the stars. And you can do this kind of work with Hubble in the yellow circle I'm showing here. So this box I'm showing you here is a map of the nearby universe, about 80 million light years on a side. And I've color-coded the map here to kind of make it a cartoon easier to see. Giant spiral galaxies like our own Milky Way or Andromeda, which is about 2.5 million light years away, are the two biggest galaxies in the nearby universe. We're in kind of a rural part of the universe, so there's not many big galaxies. You have Andromeda and the Milky Way, and then a bunch of little dwarf galaxies, the brown dots. And Hubble can do this work about a megaparsec away, about 2.5, 3 million light years away. And then it's just too hard. It takes too much time to do this kind of work. Webb can do a volume of space. This technique, instead of looking at high redshift galaxies, if you look at nearby galaxies like I'm talking about here with Hubble, Webb can do similar work at about a volume that's about three times larger than Hubble because it has a much larger mirror. But because it's working the infrared, it's actually not ideal for these kind of blue stars I'm talking about here. And really, Webb's main contribution to figuring out how old galaxies are, again, is by looking at much more distant galaxies, billions of light years away, and looking at them directly and trying to figure out how old they are by looking back in time. But that's not stellar archaeology. It's a whole different method, the subject of you could get a whole talk on that as well. And I'll just remind you in the beginning of the talk, I said the most distant galaxies Webb has seen now it's looking back to only 300 million years after the Big Bang. If you had an 8 meter Hubble, so a UV optical telescope with a much larger aperture, instead of 2.4 meter aperture and 8 meter Hubble, like a future mission, you could do this work in a much more interesting patch of the universe. So then you could start seeing more spiral galaxies like our own, and even a giant elliptical galaxy, which are these red or orange ellipse symbols I have here. And if you had a 16 meter Hubble, which you might think sounds crazy, if you had a 16-meter UV optical telescope, you'd have access to a very large sample of galaxies, including the nearest city of galaxies, which is the Coma Sculptor cloud on the upper right there. And you could really do this kind of star formation history work in much of the nearby universe and really treat it in a statistical fashion. So there is actually such a telescope in the works right now. It's the Habitable Worlds Observatory. It's the next flagship that NASA is currently studying. It's a UV optical infrared telescope, and it's currently the time scale is to try to get it launched in the 2040s. So the field of astronomy does something called the Decadal Survey every 10 years, and I'll just play this animation one more time here because it's cool. It has a big starshade here in this design concept. It got solar panels there, and then an enormous mirror anywhere in the 8 to 16 meter range that would be segmented like Webb. And probably be out at Lagrange point two like Webb as well. And probably have a baffle is what people are arguing about now, because Webb doesn't have a baffle if you've seen pictures of it, but Hubble does, and Webb's mirror gets dinged by micrometeoroids enough that people think, oh, let's go back to having a baffle again. But that's an artist's rendition there. The field of astronomy does this decadal survey every 10 years to talk about what flagship missions we'll be pursuing. Hubble was the result of one of those decadal surveys. Webb was a result of one of those decadal surveys, and so was Roman, which is launching in 2 years. And the Habitable Worlds Observatory is what arose out of the 2021 decadal survey. And again, we're hoping to launch this in the 2040s. So, just to summarize, I've talked to you earlier about the ultra-faint dwarf galaxies. So, these are galaxies that were only discovered in the past 20 years. And folks thought, so now we're finally starting to fill in the missing satellite problem. Why were these so hard to find? It's because we think that they were actually only formed stars in the very early universe and stopped forming stars. If that's true, they should be metal poor. And indeed, when we look at them with Keck, the chemical abundances in most of the stars are 0.1% to 1% of the chemistry in the sun. If this theory is true, they should also be ancient. And indeed, 75% of the stars in all the models I showed you before say that the stars formed in these galaxies about 13 billion years ago or more. So most of the star formation occurred in the very early universe. And we don't see any intermediate age stars like we do in the classical galaxies.
Excuse me.
Okay, I got two more lines here, and then we'll go to questions. Star formation appears to be synchronized. That's when I showed you them all superimposed on each other. And that synchronization would only happen if you had some kind of global cause of that synchronization, and that could be the reionization of the universe. And this is consistent with the proposed solutions to the missing satellite problem, because most of the missing satellites are there, but they just have few or no stars. So thank you.
Good talk. So, are there any? We have 2 minutes for questions. I'm not quite sure how to do this. I guess if someone has a question, just go ahead and speak up and see if it works.
Yeah, and Carl, I ran a clock so I wouldn't speed up too much. So I did it in 38 minutes, and I told you I'd try for 40. I've managed to not go full New York mode. So,
Yeah, good work, man. We really had to stay on our toes to keep up with you there. Fortunately, I'm from upstate New York, so I can follow you well enough.
Yeah, and if you have any questions about that, I'm also happy to answer any questions about Hubble or Webb, given the other half of my job is mission head for Webb and used to be mission head for Hubble. So I spend half my time doing research and half my time leading the telescope. So.
This, if these Hulking galaxies are 13 billion years old, does that mean this data would have flummoxed you, say, 20, 25 years ago or 30 years ago before dark energy?
I
Is
mean,
that?
well, guess, yeah. I mean, the age of the universe has gone through a lot of revisions in the past few decades, right? So, if we had found these galaxies at a time when we thought the universe was younger than this, it would have been one of those, crisis in cosmology moments that has happened a few times in the field. That happened a bit when I was in grad school, in fact. They found some star clusters that looked like they were older than the universe. And a lot of people were questioning, maybe the models are wrong, or maybe this. And it turned out we didn't have the age of the universe right.
Right.
We're pretty sure the universe is 13.8 billion years old now from a few missions, COBE, Planck, MAP, WMAP. They're all, looking at the relics from the Big Bang and coming up with the same answer. Yeah.
Right. I don't see anybody else trying to ask a question. So I would ask you if you could say a few words about how HST and JWST are used together scientifically, because I seem to remember before JWST was launched, or several years before it was launched, there was always the hope that Hubble would last it long enough that their mission lifetimes would overlap. So
Right.
I'm just wondering what how that's working out.
Sure. So I worked on Webb from 2008 to 2016 before launch, and then I became the Hubble mission head from 2016 to 2024. And this past year, I moved back to Webb again as the Webb mission head. And I have to say, I was getting very worried because when the last servicing mission happened in 2009, Carl, which you worked with, right? We thought maybe Hubble would last till 2016, and. With Webb launching and I have a couple pictures here I could just show you about Hubble and Webb working together while I'm talking. So we didn't think they would overlap because we thought Hubble would only last till 2016. And when Webb launched in 2021, we now think that Hubble's going to last into the 2030s. So what I'm showing you here is just a couple pictures of Hubble and Webb working together. So these are solar system now images. The first three on the left there are with Hubble. The two on the right are with Webb. So Hubble and Webb both work together on a lot of solar system missions, both doing science directly on those, and they also assist in NASA mission navigation. So remember, Hubble was used for the New Horizons mission to Pluto to help it avoid debris on the way there, and to extend the mission. They both spend a lot of time, and I just have a couple of slides here. I'm not going to go through a whole nother presentation. I just have three slides here. So they both spend a lot of time looking at exoplanets. So this is something that's pretty wild because there were no planets known outside the solar system until 1995, and Hubble launched in 1990. So Hubble launched before we knew about a single planet outside of the solar system. And now we know there are about five, we are aware of about 5,000 planets in the around nearby stars. And this is the most explosive growth in the field right now. There's a lot of folks pointing telescopes at exoplanet systems, obviously because the search for life, piques the curiosity of both professional astronomers but also the public. So Hubble and Webb are both great at looking at planets around other stars, and they can look at the atmospheres in these exoplanets. So that's on the left, a Hubble exoplanet spectrum. around an exoplanet nearby star system on right. There's one from Webb. Again, you could do the chemistry in these atmospheres around these other stars. Hubble and Webb are doing that together. And in fact, there's a new director's program kicking off this year where we're going to spend about 500 hours of time on Webb and 250 orbits on Hubble, looking at the nearest exoplanet systems to figure out why so many rocky worlds don't seem to have atmospheres, which is disconcerting because our own rocky world, Earth, has an atmosphere, obviously, but a lot of the rocky worlds in the nearby universe do not seem to have atmospheres, which is weird. The giant worlds do, but the rocky worlds do not for some weird reason.
Yes, and we NCA has a speaker coming up in a couple of months to address that. And
Okay.
I think he already spoke at the Institute a few weeks ago.
Okay, cool. Looking at nearby star formation, the pillars of creation. So here's an example of how they complement each other. So Hubble working the ultraviolet and optical on the left. Webb looking at the infrared on the right lets you peer through the dust. And then just looking at a nearby galaxy, which is the kind of work I do. So that's a spiral galaxy on the left with Hubble. So you can, Hubble's been used to study the supermassive black hole in the center, lets you look at the star formation, which is really prominent in the ultraviolet and optical. If you look at Webb at the same exact patch of sky, it looks totally different. You see this filamentary structure from the bubbles and filaments of the gas and dust in the galaxy. And in the center there, there's the composite view of Hubble and Webb. So just anticipating this question, I sometimes get asked to talk to folks visiting the Institute about Hubble and Webb, and I show how they work together. I had these three slides
Okay,
loaded
so
up.
we do have a few questions in the chat.
Sure.
Brian, do you want to ask a
Yeah.
question?
Hi, Tom. Brian Vandervik. Fascinating presentation. Thank you so much. I had a couple of questions. One was, are we any closer to understanding what dark matter is? I mean, there was a lot of talk about WMPs and MACHAs and whatnot, or whether it's just kind of a modified Newtonian gravity theory or just our theory of gravity's off. Are we any closer to answering that question? No is the short answer. I mean, I Okay. see a lot of the theorists I talk to, believe pretty strongly that, we're making headway because we've ruled out this one of many different possible explanations. But I would say there's still a lot of ground left to cover up before we eliminate them all. Some of the talk before we got started here, when Jim was talking about the Pleiades eclipse, reminded me of some of the search for dark matter. I'll mention one thing that it's not black holes, but there's a lot of different kinds of dark matter in the universe. And I'll say the coolest thing I ever saw with Hubble was a guy I work with at the Institute that Carl probably remembers, Kailash Sahu. Carl, do you remember Kailash? Right.
Absolutely.
So Kailash had what I always said was the coolest thing he did with Hubble. We know black holes exist because with telescopes like Hubble and other ones, we can see stuff falling into them and accelerating and see them in binary stars. Kailash, a long time ago, and it worked. Came to me with this cool idea that he's putting together, and he's putting together a little team to look for free-floating black holes by staring at the galactic center with Hubble and watching as black holes pass in front of stars. It reminded me when you were talking earlier, Jim, about the Pleiades eclipsing. So Kailash came and told us about a dozen of us this idea where he would just stare for a whole week at the center of the galaxy at a rich star field and see if a black hole passed in front of a star, the gravitational lensing would make the brightness go up and down again very briefly for a handful of days. And he did this, and we saw a black hole, a free-floating black hole. And he published this a couple of years ago, and it's pretty wild. And it does give you an idea that there's these stellar relics out there. Anyways, it doesn't directly answer your question because there are not enough black holes free-floating out there to answer the dark matter problem. But there are things like that. People look for MACHOs. There's, crazy ideas with neutrinos, but people don't have any idea yet, really. What is the bulk of the dark matter or the dark energy for that matter, the dark with the accelerating universe, right? Still a mystery. Another question is, so my understanding is like 300,000 years right after the Big Bang, there was a deionization of the universe, right, which made it transparent to light. Right. You're talking about the reionization. Can you explain that and how it inhibited star formation in these dwarf galaxies? Right. So the way the theorists explained this, again, it's a pretty compelling theory, but it is still just theory, is when the Big Bang first happened, the universe was extremely ionized because everything was so hot and dense. Sure. And it cooled enough, but it had not yet formed stars, that everything became neutral. And those were the dark ages. But then once the first stars and galaxies started shedding ultraviolet light through the universe, that reionized everything again. Okay. And then that's most of the pockets of star formation in the universe, like the Milky Way, which is was at the center of a huge clump of dark matter, basically. That's why we live in a large galaxy. But these classical dwarf galaxies had enough dark matter that they had enough of a gravitational well to retain their star-forming matter. But these very faint little seeds of star formation, they only had a pretty shallow gravitational well. So when the light came on, basically, they blew all the gas out of them. And so they stopped forming stars then.
So
So ironically, turning on the lights turned off the lights in a bunch of stars.
it's
Yeah, so.
got it. Thank you.
Okay, I believe Jay Miller had a question. Jay?
Yes. Yeah, my question really is about whether you know anything about what's going on in California, whether it is affected Palomar or any of the other observatories out there.
So I was talking a little before we got started with it. Just a few people were logged in. I'm not sure about the state of the different observatories. I will tell you one thing that has affected
I know JPL.
the JPL. So the Deep Space Network went down for the first time since 1964 on Wednesday and Thursday off of its primary site and went to a backup site at Goldstone Control. So they could do health and safety and commanding of, it's not just James Webb, which was the other half of my job. But there's a lot of NASA missions and other missions that are using DSN, the Deep Space Network. And failing over to the remote site gives people health and safety and commanding. But for example, on James Webb, we couldn't downlink data. But yesterday, we were able to restore functionality at the primary site, although folks are not physically sitting there at JPL. They're about 15 miles away in Monrovia, remote controlling the primary site. And there you get the full functionality still. So they're not at Goldstone, they're in Monrovia. Yeah, so they did evacuate JPL. That was a big deal. And as you said, some of the other observatories, Mount Wilson, everything, they're all threatened. It's pretty scary.
Okay, we had another question in the chat from Jim Kaiser. Jim, do you want to ask your question? You're muted. Unmute yourself. So his question, why has there been no stellar evolution in the dwarf galaxies? What does it mean to say that stellar evolution was snuffed out permanently?
So when the group of stars was born in these ultra-faint dwarf galaxies, you had high-mass stars and low-mass stars. And the high-mass stars, ironically, they have more fuel, but they burn it much more rapidly. So the stellar lifetime of star, like our own star, it'll take about 10 billion years total to burn all the hydrogen and become a red giant, right? So we're about halfway through that right now. But more massive stars that are, many times more massive than the sun. When they're born, they only live, hundreds of millions of years, and then they blow up. So when I showed you those diagrams earlier, basically the ultra-faint dwarf galaxies had a wide range of masses 13 billion years ago that were all formed, and the most massive stars evolved and disappeared. Those are gone now, and all that you're left with are the lower mass stars. And at an age of 13 billion years, we have stars at about 80% of the mass of the sun and lighter. So down to about a tenth of the mass of the sun. So and going down to brown dwarf level, and those things will live forever. I mean, hundreds of billions of years. But so the range of masses we have today, those stars are still peeling off the main sequence. So the ones that are peeling off today, they're about 80% the mass of the sun. A little bit further down the line in the future, when none of us are here anymore, there'll be that little kink will be down to 0.7 solar masses, and then it'll go down to 0.6. That kink will keep marching down to lower masses in that diagram as the more massive stars peel off and evolve off. So in the very early, stellar evolution is still happening, but new stars are not being born. That's what I mean is being snuffed out. Normally in a galaxy, you have the stars that were born a long time ago. They're all evolving and continuing on their way, and new stars are replenishing. That's not happening here. It's just the stars we started with 13 billion years ago. So that's what's weird in these ultra-faint dwarf galaxies. 13 billion years ago, you had this wide range of masses, but then the most massive ones are all gone now, and all you're left with are the low-mass stars. So that's how we know how they're old.
Okay, I believe we have a question from Carl, then Jim, then Guy. So, Carl?
Yeah, I just wanted to come and say a few words about the current operational state of Hubble and whatever you can say in public about future end of life plans.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's some things I can say in public. Yeah. So up until July, I was the Hubble mission head, and it was pretty busy because you may have seen in the news, Hubble was suffering from gyroscope problems all through 2023. And we were safing the observatory sometimes a few times a week. So I can tell you, my wife was not thrilled with my phone was set to play a Viking horn and wake me up every time this happened. And so that kind of got old in a hurry. We had three operating gyroscopes, and we were trying to keep all three going as long as possible because you get the full sky at any one time when you have three gyros. Once we go to reduced gyro mode, is what we call it, we can operate Hubble and do all the science, for the most part, on just one or two gyros. And that's why we know Hubble will last into the 2030s. We can keep going on one or two gyros, but we were hesitant to turn off one of the three and go below three, because with just two gyros, you only get half the sky at any one time. The whole sky comes into the view over the course of the year, but at any one time, you only get half the sky. And that means if some cool thing happens, like a supernova explodes in the half the sky where you can't look, you can't point Hubble at it, right? So we were trying to give full view of the sky as much as possible. In the past spring, we finally threw in the towel on that gyro that was glitching all the time. It's not turned off, it's still powered on, so it's not in the control loop. And we're now currently operating with two gyros, and Hubble's working fine. It's actually one gyro mode. We have two that could be used in the control loop, and one is pointing at any one time. It works equally well with two or one. And we can stay that way into the 2030s. The next thing that'll probably bite us is reentry. The median reentry date at the moment is about August 2033. And that has pulled to the left a little bit. It used to be a little later than that, but as you probably know, solar activity has been pretty prominent the past couple of years. That puffs up the atmosphere, increases atmospheric drag. And in fact, the altitude plot of Hubble's altitude versus time, it looks kind of scary to folks who don't know what's going on, just because it's been accelerating, just because it's getting lower in the atmosphere anyway, so it goes quicker. And we knew that was going to happen. But the fact that Solar Max has been as intense as it has been did accelerate it a bit. So now we're talking about the median reentry date is August 2033. NASA has always stated publicly, I don't work at NASA, right? I work for the consortium of universities that run the telescopes, AURA. But NASA has stated publicly that they will either want to boost Hubble to a parking orbit or bring it down gracefully. So we'll see what happens. So right now it's unclear what's going to happen, but the current median reentry date is 2033, Carl, and we think it'll keep working till then. Besides the gyros, which things are much calmer now, turning off the glitchy gyro, and Julia Roman Duval, who was my deputy when I was Hubble mission head, she's now the interim mission head for Hubble. She's sleeping better than I was because it's not going off as often, so that's great. The other thing that's a little tricky is the payload computer is currently on one string. It used to be two strings when you were at the Institute, the SICNDH. That we lost a side in the summer of 2021. The really smart folks at the Institute and Goddard, who work in ops, have come up with a way to bring up the other side that shorted out. So we're going to have redundancy again soon, hopefully. Yeah, but right at the moment, we're single string on the payload computer. So that's the other thing. But again, we think Hubble will last into the 2030s. But those are the. That's the operational state. Sorry, you get me going about the telescope. I'll babble all day. Yes.
No, thanks. That's good. Thanks.
Okay, Jim, you had a question?
Sure. I just wanted to, early in your presentation, you talked about the dark matter, amount of dark matter in the ultra, in the small, in the dwarf galaxies. Could you elaborate about how you determined that?
Yeah, sure. So that comes from the Keck spectroscopy, actually, of the stars in these galaxies. So people obtained Keck spectra of the red giant stars. It's hard for them to get down to the main sequence stars. They're a little too faint for getting accurate spectra. But they do the spectra for two things. One, to get the chemistry. So that's how you get these low chemical abundances in these stars. But then also from the radial velocities, you can actually look at the ensemble of stars in these galaxies. They have so few stars, you can actually get a reasonable fraction of the stars and get spectra of them all, because these things have so few stars. And if you look at the distribution of velocities, there's a lot of dispersion, and they wouldn't be gravitationally bound unless there was a lot of dark matter there, given the velocities. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, Guy, did you want to make your comments?
Yeah, just one comment that both the Rubin and the Roman telescopes are named after illustrious but now deceased NCA members. And yeah, that's my comment.
Sure.
Okay, Chris, you have a question?
Yeah, just a real quick one, I hope. You mentioned these even these ultra dwarf galaxies had high solar mass, high mass stars. Presumably, those ended life as supernovae. Is there any value in, or benefit, or anything to be learned by, identifying and studying the remnants of the supernovae in these dwarf galaxies? Or is that just interesting, trivial,
No,
superfluous?
it's interesting from a chemical evolution point of view because these stars that I mentioned, they're metal poor, but they're not totally pristine, like born in from right after the Big Bang. They have a little bit of pollution, and that's from supernova in the very early universe. Now we can't see the remnants. When you go out on the night sky and see supernova remnants like the Crab Nebula, nebula or something like that, those usually haven't dispersed on the order of thousands of years. But when you're talking about supernovae that happened 13 billion years ago, there's no trace of any remnant left, like in terms of some kind of spectacular supernova remnant. But what you can see is actually how crazy stochastic the chemical distribution is in these galaxies. So the stars, and this is another thing that's weird about these galaxies, you don't have a smooth distribution of chemistry. You see this very spiky distribution. That's because it's just a handful of stars and a few supernova polluted things, and everything stopped happening. And so you can actually see the fingerprints of these supernova in the chemistry from Keck. But that's the only way to really see the supernova remnants. You can't see the beautiful remnants we see for nearby supernova remnants. You can only see kind of their chemical footprints left behind.
Very cool. Are there
Very
any more
cool. Thank you.
questions? All right. Like to thank Dr. Brown for his awesome presentation.
Amazing.
I see a lot of new names in the participating, and I'd love to hear how you heard about the meeting, and if you're a member, you can drop that in the chat. Our next meeting is coming up on February 8th, I believe.
That's right.
February 8th. And so that one will be a hybrid meeting. So long weather allows us to, we sometimes get those crazy snowstorms or whatever. We'll be meeting at the observatory as well as on Zoom. So hopefully we'll see many of you in person next month as well. But if there are no other questions, Guy, do you have any final words?
No, I just say thank you very much for an excellent talk. This was one of the best I've seen in a long time. Thank
Well,
you
thank
so
you very
much.
much for having me. And if anyone has any questions about Hubble or Webb or this research or anything else, feel free to shoot me an email or anything like that. My institute email is on the web, pretty easy to find. I answer questions from the public all the time, especially folks interested like yourselves. I'm happy to do it. And please don't call me Dr. Brown when you send me an email. Tom's fine. I talk to school kids all the time, and I don't ask them to call me Dr. Brown either, just see Tom. So, but thank you very much for having me here. It was fun talking to you all, and let me share the research. So thanks.
Thanks,
Thank
Bob.
you.
Thank you very
Thank you
much.
very much. Thanks again.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Have a good night.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good night. Thank you.
Good night.
Well,
Thank you, Todd. So you should be able to stop recording if you haven't already.
I hit stop recording. I
All
didn't
right,
hear an
good.
announcement or anything.
And then when we close, it'll probably do that thing, and it'll take a little while
Yeah,
to convert. And
that's
I'll
fine.
get with you about transferring the files a little bit later.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very, very much for kind of
You're
starting
welcome.
the meeting and everything. That was a great relief that
You're
I didn't
welcome.
have to worry about because we were driving and in and out of connection and stuff. So
Yeah.
that was a great relief.
No problem. You're welcome.
All right, then anyone else have any final questions? And we're going to probably close it. I'm an hour ahead of y'all, so for me, it's already almost 10 o'clock. So,
Well, if anybody who's still on here has things to say about Jeff, I would like to put
yeah.
something in the next newsletter.
Yeah,
Anybody who knew him better than I do.
we'll ping both Guy and some of the other officers to make a note about that. Yes.
Yeah.
All right, sounds good.
Okay.
Right. Good night, everyone. Thank you.
Night. Night. Do I just?
Yeah, you hit the end button at the bottom, right?
Okay. End meeting for all. See ya.
Yep.